Good afternoon, everyone. Glad to see you all back. I hope you had a meaningful feast wherever you kept it. I was keeping the feast with about 70 brethren in Le Grand Mot in the Provence region of southeastern France. The location is a beautiful area. It's close to the Mediterranean Sea. And with all the brethren staying at the same family resort where services were held, I was able to meet every single person. The fact that we had all of our meals together, 25 meals in total, it's not that hard to meet all 70 persons. Some of our brethren do not speak English, but with the help of brethren who are fluent in both English and French, they can serve as translator, and it was possible to have a good conversation. There was also a Living Church of God feast site about 70 minutes away from the UCG site. After the feast in Paris, I had dinner with about 15 brethren who were at the LCG site who were also traveling back home through Paris. And there was the expression by multiple people about it would be great for all of us to be together. And I told one person, not a single word uttered from the lectern at the UCG site would be objectionable to anybody in LCG. And he replied, that would be of no surprise to me. And on the Sabbath, after the feast in Paris, I was with brethren at a service from multiple fellowships in the Church of God who were making their way back home through Paris. So God's people can worship together and fellowship together in peace. Well, this will be a different kind of message. I do not have just one topic or one scriptural passage to expound upon. This message consists of a number of miscellaneous observations from the feast this year and my sojourn associated with it. So let's title this Observations from Feast 2014. I just realized I didn't bring up my Bible. Can someone... I was on a tour around Nice in an area known as the French Riviera, and I was listening to a conversation of some of the people on the tour. These were not church members. This was an American couple currently living in Kazakhstan, and the husband and wife have been in the oil business their whole life. It's taken them to Texas, the Middle East, Angola, and now Kazakhstan. He's on the operations side, she's on the finance side, and they were talking about the corruption that they saw in Angola. It was like nowhere else that they've ever seen. One of the Americans on the tour said she knew of someone who had invested in Angola and suffered a tremendous loss. A whole shipping container, when it was opened, was found completely empty of its contents, $400,000 worth lost. Not a loss of profit, but a complete loss of one's supplies. Corruption is an ugly word. And it exists in varying degrees all over this world. Years ago, I heard a story of a minister in the Church of God in Africa. He was expecting the shipment of a Jeep that was paid for by the brethren in the UK to arrive at the port of this African nation. The minister was at the port on the delivery date, and he saw that Jeep being lifted off the boat. Unfortunately, there was some top military official there that day at the port, and he saw that Jeep come off the ship, and he thought, maybe I'll just claim it. And that was a huge problem. So this minister, well, you do the same thing you do first, and that's pray. Secondly, he went to the military leader and said, this Jeep is supposed to be for the organization that publishes the Plain Truth magazine, and this Jeep is needed to help in its work. Well, believe it or not, the general recognized the Plain Truth magazine and said, I know that magazine. It's a good magazine. Now, maybe he didn't read the magazine and follow what it taught, but nevertheless, he released the claim on that Jeep. So that situation turned out okay. But again, corruption in this world is an ugly word. You know, ignorance is bliss. So when we don't see corruption or don't experience it directly, it doesn't bother us much. But when we do see it and it impacts us or our neighbor, We are deeply troubled by it. Corruption corrodes people, relationship between people. It corrodes systems and processes that are supposed to be just. And once corruption starts, it's very difficult to uproot. And when we think of corruption, we think of organized crime or some fancy scheme. But it all begins in the individual heart, and the Bible says a lot with regard to the individual. Let me turn to Deuteronomy 25. My first observation here is just a musing on corruption brought about by that conversation. Deuteronomy 25, verses 13 to 16. Verse 13 says, "You shall not have in your bag differing weights, a heavy and a light. You shall not have in your house differing measures, a large and a small. You shall have a perfect and just weight, a perfect and just measure, that your days may be lengthened in the land which the Lord your God is giving you." Verse 16, "For all who do such things, all who behave unrighteously, are an abomination to the Lord your God." Proverbs 11:1 says, "A false balance is an abomination to the Lord, but a just weight is his delight." Regarding bribes, in Exodus 23:8, it says, "And you shall take no bribe, for a bribe blinds the discerning and perverts the words of righteousness." So in the world tomorrow, the millennium, we'll see an end to the corruption that we see, the bribery, the thuggery that goes along with it. But as for now, it's a good reminder for us to examine ourselves to make sure that we are always dealing with a true measure and a true weight in dealing with others, and that we are not dealing in the ways of corruption and bribery. Observation number two. When traveling internationally, it's always interesting to see what television networks are available. And in the hotel in the south of France, I found a French, German, Italian, English, Spanish, Japanese, Chinese, and Arabic channels. Now, that's not unusual for Europe, especially in a tourist spot. But what was surprising to me was the number of Middle Eastern television networks. I counted 14. Al Jazeera, Qatar TV, Saudi TV, Kuwait TV, Al Arabiya, Jordan TV, the Egyptian satellite network, 3 Dubai networks, Oman TV, Sudan TV, Al Arabiya, TRT Turk. Maybe that's not so strange either, because sizable numbers of people from the Middle East every summer head to Europe to escape the desert heat. Let's turn to Daniel chapter 12, verse 4. Daniel chapter 12, verse 4. I want to read this verse out of a prophecy. Daniel 12, verse 4. It says, "But you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase." So this is an end time prophecy. And in the end time, many are going to be running to and fro, and there's going to be an increase in knowledge. Now, it's certainly possible that the running to and fro can refer to people running to and fro, one idea to another, and, you know, not committing to any of them. But the immediate and primary meaning seems to be that it's a time when travel is easier and that knowledge has increased. So you know that the great advances of transportation have occurred within the last 200 years, and the information age is basically something of the last 50 years. This end time condition of easy travel and increase in knowledge has an upside, it has a downside. But it's a characteristic of this age. And that's what I thought about when I noticed that there were 14 Middle Eastern satellite TV channels available in my hotel. Observation number three. One of the wealthiest areas in the world is Monaco. Monaco is a nation, it's a principality that's on the Mediterranean, completely surrounded by France. It's near the Italian border. One of its districts is the fabled Monte Carlo. Monaco is about the size of New York Central Park, 35,000 residents. Real estate there is about 50,000 euro a square meter. Let me convert that. $5,800 a square foot. And when you, what you see in the marina at, in Monte Carlo are not just yachts, they're mega yachts. So some of the wealthiest people in the world visit Monaco in the summer with their mega yachts. And some of them pay unbelievable prices to get the right berth location so that they have a good view for the annual Monaco Grand Prix, a Formula One race. So Monaco is a place that's pretty from the outside. But as one of our French brethren told me, the wealth is very showy in Monaco. And of course, the Bible emphasizes the kind of beauty that's based upon lasting values and not that which is on the surface. Let's turn to 1 Timothy chapter 6. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 6 to 10. 1 Timothy 6, 6, it says, "Now godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into this world, and it's certain we can carry nothing out. And having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and harmful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money," not just money, "the love of money, is a root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows." There's nothing wrong with wealth honestly attained. There's nothing wrong with having a yacht. But what is one's attitude to what a person has, whether it's a lot or it's a little? God gives a warning through the pen of Paul. And we know from the Bible God has blessed some of his people with tremendous wealth, and that wealth can do a lot of nice things according to his will. But with the wrong attitude, that wealth or the pursuit of it is actually a curse, bringing sorrow and not a blessing. Unless we think that this warning is only for the rich, you know, the millionaires and the billionaires, let's remember here in America, by the standards of human history, by the standards of the world as a whole, all of us are rich. We have conveniences and luxuries and opportunities that only the kings of old would dream of. So that's some of what I thought about when I was in Monaco. Observation number 4. Before the feast, some would ask why I was going to France, and I joked that I was going there for the vegetables. That's actually the truth in part. Let me read from Fedor's travel guide to the Provence region of France. "Don't be surprised if colors and flavors seem more intense in Provence. It could be that the hot, dry climate, which concentrates the essence of fruit and vegetables, or the sun beaming down on market tables overflowing with produce. Provence's rustic cuisine, based on local tomatoes, garlic, olive oil, anchovies, olives, and native wild herbs, including basil, lavender, mint, rosemary, thyme, and sage, has more in common with other Mediterranean cuisines than it does with the most regional French fare. Everywhere you'll find sun-ripened fruit dripping with nectar and vegetables so flavor-packed that meat may seem like a mere accessory." Now, it's a travel guide, so consider that. But the point is, the Provence region is a bountiful region. And at the restaurant and the feast site, they made available on the buffet table leafy local lettuces and flavorful tomatoes and cucumbers and eggplant and zucchini and beans and broccoli, potatoes, including French fries, carrots, lentils, spinach, both in the cold salads as well as the cooked food. And of course, there's the wonderful local wine production there as well. We didn't only eat vegetables, of course. There was plenty of good meats and cheeses and soups and desserts. In the millennium, in the world tomorrow, there will be a restoration of good agricultural practice. You know, in this world, agricultural work for many is a curse. They do not own their own land. The pay and the working conditions are not good. So we often see in a third world nation sometimes when a factory, let's say making tennis shoes, opens up, the line to apply for jobs goes a long way down the road. They're willing to earn a few dollars a day and get better pay and better working conditions than what they had on the farm. In other places of this world, people have their land, but they struggle to eke out a living on it because soil conditions and the climate are poor. So good farmland is not equally distributed throughout the world. Not everywhere has the productivity of, let's say, the Provence region of France. Micah 4:4, you don't need to turn there, is a verse that says, "Everyone shall sit under his vine and under his fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid." Let's turn to Amos chapter 9, verses 11 to 14. We'll get another millennial passage. Amos chapter 9, verses 11 to 14. Verse 11 says, "On that day I will raise up the tabernacle of David which has fallen down and repair its damages. I will raise up its ruins and rebuild it as the days of old." I'll comment, this is not a fulfilled prophecy regarding the modern nation of Israel in 1948. This is yet future. "That they may possess the remnant of Edom and all the Gentiles who are called by my name, says the Lord who does this thing." Verse 13. "Behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, when the plowman shall overtake the reaper and the treader of grapes him who sows seed. The mountains shall drip with sweet wine and all the hills shall flow with it." So verse 13 is talking about agricultural bounty. And when it's time to plow, people are still busy reaping what's still there in the field. And when it's time to plant, they still haven't exhausted all the grapes yet to make wine. Verse 14, "I will bring back the captives of my people Israel. They shall build the waste cities and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and drink wine from them. They shall also make gardens and eat fruit from them." So we'll see that there will be a healthy respect by everyone of where their food and drink comes from, whether their primary work is related to agriculture or not. And agriculture will not be the curse that it often is today for many who are landless and many struggling with poor and worn out soils. And part of the solution in the millennium will be the practice of the land Sabbath as well as the institution of the Jubilee, and both are part of God's instruction to mankind. Observation number 5. One thing that's amazing to me is how many people in the world no English, or at least some phrases in English. Now, don't get the idea that the majority of people in France speak English fluently. They don't. But I saw a number of examples like this, where, for example, the French hotel desk clerk is trying to talk to an Italian woman, and they aren't communicating, and finally they resort to English and understand each other. At one restaurant, the German customer wanted to get the bill, and he said something to the waiter, and the waiter didn't understand. The French waiter said something back to him in French he didn't understand. Finally, the French waiter says, "Do you want to pay?" The German customer says, "Yes." In my work, I attend technical meetings where engineers meet from all over the world, that's North America, Europe, and Asia, to discuss technical standards and specifications. The rule of this committee is that all the documents and all the discussion must be in English. So this means the participant from Japan or Korea or Denmark or Italy must be fluent in English. How did English get to be the most spoken language? Or let's say even the required language. Approaching the end time, who would dominate not only militarily and economically, but also culturally? Let's turn to Genesis chapter 48. Genesis 48. Most of you have been to these passages before, but it's good to get a reminder. Genesis 48, 19 to 20. And this is Jacob speaking. It says, Genesis 48, verse 19, "But his father refused and said, 'I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people. He also shall be great.'" So this is referring to the older son of Joseph, Manasseh. "But truly his younger son, which was Ephraim, shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations." Verse 20, "So he blessed them that day, saying, 'By you Israel will bless, saying, may God make you as Ephraim and as Manasseh.' And thus he set Ephraim before Manasseh." And we would understand the modern identity of Manasseh to be the United States, and the modern identity of Ephraim to be Britain and its empire. Let's go to chapter 49, verses 22 to 26. Genesis 49, 22 to 26. So this is talking about Joseph, but Joseph refers to his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. "Joseph is a fruitful bow by a well. His branches run over the wall. The archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him, and hated him, but his bow remained in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. From there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel." Verse 25, "By the God of your father who will help you, and by the Almighty who will bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lies beneath, blessings of the breast and the wombs, and the blessings of your father have excelled the blessing of my ancestors up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. They shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him who is separate from his brothers." There's obviously a lot of symbolic language here, but you get the overall idea. Economic blessings, military blessings, and tied in with that, I would think, especially in this end time, would be cultural power. Now, all those things can be rightly used or wrongly used. And Ephraim and Manasseh will be judged on how we use them. This is something that I thought about as I was hearing all sorts of travelers speaking English in Europe. Observation number 6. One of the excursions during the feast was to the medieval city of Avignon. It's a little souvenir book of Avignon, and this is one of the prominent buildings there. This is a picture of the Palace of the Popes. Now, believe it or not, there was a 70-year period when the popes were French, and that their court presided out of Avignon, France, and not Rome. Let me read from this little book. It says, "The influence of the King of France on the Pope became so great that it could be termed actual interference. This resulted in the growing up of a movement clamoring for the Pope to return to Rome, his natural seat." Now, in 1367, there was a Pope named Urban V, and he was ready to move back to Rome. But the King of France exerted pressure and kept him in Avignon. His successor, Gregory XI, made the move to Rome in 1377, but there were going to be consequences, because following the death of Gregory, there was a conclave to name the next pope, and they named an Italian. That was Urban VI. The French cardinals found that completely unacceptable, and they in turn elected Robert of Geneva, of course a Frenchman, as Pope, who became Clement VII, and that court was set up in Avignon. So now we have a Pope holding office in Rome, and we also have a Pope holding office in Avignon. Let me read again from this booklet. "Reciprocally excommunicated, the Pope and the anti-pope," referring to the one in Avignon, "went all out to defeat each other. After long drawn out vicissitudes, in which there was even a third pretender to the papal throne, and complicated bargaining and negotiations, The Council of Constance was held in 1414. At this time, both contenders renounced their claims, and Martin V was elected pope. So that healed the schism. Let's turn to Revelations chapter 17, and we'll read verses 1 through 6. Revelation 17, 1 through 6. Verse 1 says, "Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying to me, 'Come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication.'" Verse 3, "So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns." Verse 4, "The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication, and on her forehead a name was written, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. I saw the woman drunk with the blood of saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus, and when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement." So we have a prophecy here using symbolic language, talking about the existence of a great church who's entangled with secular powers, who is drunk on the blood of the saints. And this great church and the secular powers have an intimate relationship, which in verse 2 is pictured as fornication. And at times, this great church exerted great pressure and power on the secular powers, and then at other times, those secular powers exerted great pressure and influence on this church. And what I gave you was just a little snippet from the 1300s and 1400s in France of this entanglement of church and state. I didn't go into all the political intrigue. The political intrigue brings to mind the old saying, truth is stranger than fiction, or another version of that is, you just can't make that stuff up. Now, here in America, we don't have reminders of this church-state entanglement for the most part, but in Europe, the historical markers are very obvious and more prevalent. And another site we visited was the town of Aigues-Mortes. Aigues-Mortes was where the 7th and the 8th Crusades were launched. But that town also played a role in the crusade against the Albigensians of southern France, people who were branded as heretics because they were opposed to Rome. And in this town, there is a tower called the Tower of Constance, and that was used to hold prisoners. So by 1200, there were whole communities in southern France that were considered to be Albigensian. And there is the possibility that some in the Church of God who had the testimony of Jesus Christ and who kept the commandments were moving through Albigensian areas. And it was during the Albigensian Crusade that the Inquisition began. So this would be another episode of church-state entanglement talked about in Revelation 17 that resulted in the shedding of blood of the saints. Finally, observation number 7. Most of you heard Mr. Kubik's barn burner of a sermon during the feast from Panama City. We heard it delayed. We saw it the next day. Among other things, he reminded us that Matthew 24 can't be read just on its own. It has to be read along with Matthew 25, because Matthew 25 continues the discussion of Matthew 24 to be spiritually ready, to be utilizing the resources that we have been given, and to know what we need to do in regards to others. Now, in the past, I've talked about Matthew 25, and I referred to it as the three parables of Matthew 25. But Mr. Kubik made an interesting point, and so I stand corrected. He said Matthew 25 is composed of two parables and a scenario. Let's turn to Matthew 25, verse 31. Matthew 25, verse 31. Now, the first part of Matthew 25 is the parable of the virgins. The second part is the parable of the talents. Verse 31 is the sheep and goats episode, but verse 31 says, "When the Son of Man comes in His glory, and all the holy angels with Him, then He will sit on the throne of His glory." So it says the Son of Man. It doesn't say some master of the house or some master of the vine, of the vineyard. There's no seemingly a character like in a parable. This is the Son of Man, and thus not a parable. So this is a scenario involving Jesus Christ. So it's in expounding verses 31 to 46, I noticed Mr. Kubik did not spiritualize in any way the physical application of this passage. Yes, there seems to be the presence of a spiritual allegory. We can talk about the spiritually hungry, the spiritually thirsty, the spiritually in prison, the spiritually naked, spiritually estranged, so forth. However, to the audience who is listening to Jesus Christ, and for people throughout the ages who are reading this, the primary application seems immediate and obvious. It applies to physically hungry people, physically thirsty, physically sick, physically estranged, physically imprisoned, physically naked. So the judgment on the sheep and the goats is based upon how they reacted to persons in these situation. So the primary application of this verse is the physical, and that's how Mr. Kubik discussed it. Let me just tie in one other scripture in this vein to this, and that's Isaiah 11:6. You don't need to turn there, but we often read that during the feast where it says, "The wolf also shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the young goat." Now, some may jump right to the spiritual allegory and talk about how people with predatory or aggressor characteristics will have to learn the way of peace. And the symbolic meaning is totally consistent with the millennium. But the primary and obvious meaning should not be ignored. Literal beasts of prey will not be beasts of prey any longer. They will eat the herb, as did those beasts in the Garden of Eden, as indicated in Genesis 1. This change in the nature of animals, a literal change in the nature of animals, is indicative of all sorts of other changes. When the text warrants, the spiritual allegory in any passage can be very valuable, but the more immediate physical application cannot be ignored. And therefore, as followers of God, we all have the challenge of applying the instruction of the sheep and the goats in our lives. So these were seven miscellaneous observations based on my experience at the feast and sojourn to and from it. I am sure that you have your observations and lessons learned from Feast 2014, no matter where you were keeping it. Let's rehearse and think about what God has taught us this year at Feast 2014. Through both the hearing and the doing.